The following is a message from George Trujillo, a data strategist at DataStax. As a reminder, DataStax is the only financial sponsor of Data Mesh Radio and the Data Mesh Learning community at this time. I work with George, and I would highly recommend speaking with him. It's always a fun conversation.
One of the key value propositions of a data mesh is empowering lines of business to innovate with data. So it's been really exciting for me personally to see data mesh in practice and how it's maturing. This is a significant organizational transformation, so it must be well understood. Empowering developers, analysts, and data scientists with downstream data has been part of my personal data journey that reemphasized the importance of reducing complexity in real-time data ecosystems and the criticality of picking the right real-time data technology stack. I'm always open and welcome the opportunity to share experiences and ideas around executing a data mesh strategy. Feel free to email or connect with me on LinkedIn if you'd like to talk about real-time data ecosystems, data management strategies, or data mesh. The contact information can be found in the notes below. Thank you.
A written transcript of this episode is provided by Starburst. For more information, you can see the show notes.
Welcome to Data Mesh Radio with your host, Scott Hurlman, sponsored by Starburst. This is Adrian Estala, VP and Field CDO at Starburst, and host of Data Mesh TV. Starburst is the leading contributor to Trino, the open source project, and the Data Mesh for Dummies book that I co-wrote with Colleen Tarto and Andy Mott. To claim your free book, head over to starburst.io.
Data Mesh Radio, a part of the Data as a Product podcast network, is a free community resource provided by DataStax. Data Mesh Radio is produced and hosted by Scott Hurlman, the co-founder of the Data Mesh Learning Community. This podcast is designed to help you get up to speed on a number of data mesh-related topics. Hopefully, you find it useful. Bottom line up front, what are you going to hear about and learn about in this episode? I interviewed Vlad Kononoff, who's the author of Learning Domain-Driven Design, or DDD, through O'Reilly. He's a senior cloud architect at Doit International and an independent consultant on DDD and distributed systems. Before we jump in, the phrase DDD is used a lot in this episode. Again, it stands for Domain-Driven Design. We've had past episodes around DDD as a concept, but it was mostly related to DDD for data. I want to make it clear what that kind of means when we say that. It's also important to note there are some very specific terms used in DDD, and it is easy to get overwhelmed. Look for the meaning and ignore the terms a lot of what we're talking about. We are designing how things work together, whether that's business capabilities, software systems, or general data flows. That's what we're trying to achieve. There's also the importance of the difference between a published language and a ubiquitous language in DDD. Essentially, the ubiquitous language is the language of the domain within the domain when talking between the software engineers and the kind of subject matter experts, or in Data Mesh's case, the data people and the subject matter experts. So that's within the domain. The published language is the language used to share information from that domain externally to other domains. So again, ubiquitous is internal facing between the business and the software engineers inside the domain, and the published language is external facing to the rest of the organization. So some key takeaways or thoughts from Vlad's point of view before we jump into the episode. Number one, DDD is a big topic to learn. You don't have to learn every aspect to take good value from it. You know, you don't want to try and skip as much as you can, but there's also going to be certain things that are just not useful or valuable to you, and that's okay. Number two, make the implicit explicit. I've said this on a lot of episodes as well. The more something is explicit, the easier it is to manage and manage people's understanding of it. Number three, it's important that the published language doesn't change as often as the underlying implementation model within the domain. But we also absolutely need to be able to evolve our published language. In data historically, we have trained consumers, or consumers have believed we won't evolve the published language, and have tied that too closely to the implementation model. It's caused a whole lot of issues. Number four, this one's kind of controversial, but it's kind of not as well. You'll see if you dig into the episode. The concept of a domain in data mesh is very different from in domain-driven design. In DDD, you can really only identify business boundaries, but in data mesh, or in general DDD for data, you can actually have an impact on and potentially change those boundaries. Number five, iteration is a key aspect of DDD. It's not about getting it perfect. It's about getting to okay fast and improving. Learning to do that in data will be tough, but it's pretty important to be able to do something like data mesh. Number six, it's crucial to understand the difference between the ubiquitous language, again, the language of the domain used inside the domain, and the published language, the language or the interfaces used to communicate across domain boundaries. In data mesh, data products should be in the published language to make them useful outside of the domain. Number seven, DDD helps you to learn more about the business domain and provides patterns to help design software system. But its, you know, kind of biggest benefit is that it provides a bridge between the business needs of the domain and the software systems. The number eight, the reason organizations exist is not to ship software. They exist to execute on a goal or a set of goals, typically something like driving shareholder value, and software is merely a vehicle to that. Think about data the same way. Companies don't exist to do data work. They exist to actually do something with that data. Number nine, a key aspect of domain-driven design is communication across boundaries, whether machine or human to human. So finding and defining those boundaries becomes key to prevent, or at least manage, business friction. Number 10, in DDD, it's important to not mix up domains and business capabilities. Domains are about finding coherent sets of use cases for software systems. Business capabilities is the hierarchical structure many think of when using that phrase of domain. Number 11, a model is a cornerstone concept in DDD. It's how we look to solve a problem in software rather than trying to reflect the actual exact real world in the software. Number 12, it's crucial in DDD to get the software engineers to speak in the language of the domain. Again, that ubiquitous language. In order to design systems to appropriately solve the business problems of the domains. In data mesh, we need to learn to embed the business context in the data we share in a similar approach of finding a language of the domain, but balance that with using the published language. Because again, the ubiquitous language is that internal facing language, so we can't only try and expose that. It's just not going to go well. Number 13, in DDD, it's okay to have one implementation shared via multiple published languages, especially as different versions when the implementation model is kind of changing. We have to figure out how that versioning works with data, especially when the change is outside the hands of the producing domain. Something like purchasing external data sets that then change and we don't have the ability to say, you know, don't change. Number 14, in DDD, it's okay to have more specific integration contracts for implementations for the job at hand instead of one kind of jack of all trades integration contract. In data, this could be multiple views of the same general information instead of a single data model to share all the aspects. Or it could be multiple APIs off the same data product, a lot of different kind of approaches there. But there's some good learning we can take from DDD. Number 15, to get to a good published language in DDD, ask the people consuming from your domain, you know, the counterparty in your integration contract. it makes sense in Data Mesh too to ask people what they want. Take that feedback and look for general purpose ways of structuring and sharing data. But you have partners. You don't have to design everything in your own head. You can ask them what they want. Number 16, the anti-corruption layer in DDD is important. It is created by someone consuming from other domains and is a protection against, you know, kind of ineffective models. Specifically, something that would contradict that consuming domain's internal model. It doesn't mean necessarily that those models are bad. They're just ineffective for what that domain is trying to do with that, you know, kind of producing domain's information. In Data Mesh, this is made all the more important if we don't have shared taxonomies. You're going to have a lot of issues of consuming information from other domains if they use, you know, a term to mean something that you don't use that exact same term to mean, or that you use that term to mean something else. And finally, number 17, pain isn't necessarily bad. In our bodies, pain is a signal something is wrong. In software, friction, you know, pain signals are often ignored, but shouldn't be. In data, we need to get way more explicit about when pain comes up and where it's actually coming from. With that bottom line up front done, let's jump into the interview. Okay, very, very excited for today's episode. I've got Vlad Kononov here, who is the Senior Cloud Architect at Doit International and is also a software engineering consultant. And then he's also the author of Learning Domain-Driven Design, that book through O'Reilly. So we'll talk a little bit about the book and what he's kind of learned from writing that and kind of the DDD or Domain-Driven Design community. We're also going to talk about kind of how do we think about domain-driven design and then taking it and pushing it towards data, right? How do we as well talk with each other to actually get to what's called a ubiquitous language, right? Where we're actually exchanging context in the same meaning and understanding of things. And then what Vlad's seen that's worked well in DDD for data, what does a domain even mean in the data mesh concept, because there's domains and subdomains and subdomains, you know, how do you start to communicate about that? And is it a two pizza team or is it, you know, your 5,000 person line of business organization or whatever? And then a big one that's been rattling all around for me a lot is like, we can't constantly have change. So we need to measure when we do need to change, when we do need to iterate, but like, how can you detect when things have kind of moved away from you and you should then reevaluate? And that's also going to be kind of squishy, kind of fluffy. There's not like a, and when this is the exact thing, but like, how do you start to look for those? How do you detect for those? So with that as kind of the backdrop, if you don't mind, Vlad, if you could give people a bit of an introduction to yourself, and then we can jump into the conversation at hand.
Sure. Thank you, Scott. So my name is Vlad Kononov. Usually I wear two hats. My first hat is I'm a senior cloud architect at a company called Doit International, where I specialize in designing and helping our customers to build cloud-based solutions. And my second hat is of an independent consultant specializing in domain-driven design and distributed systems in general. As you've mentioned, I authored a number of books on domain-driven design. The first one is What is Domain-Driven Design? And the second one is Learning Domain-Driven Design. And at the moment, I'm working on what I hope to be is going to be my last book ever because I don't want to keep writing anymore. So that one is called Balancing Coupling in Software Design. It's more general software design book, and I think we're going to cover some of its material today as well.
Yeah, I think that concept of how much do we decentralize? How much do we decouple? Like when you're like, okay, nothing can ever be coupled versus loosely coupling and things like that. It's an important aspect to think about how we can iterate and not be blocked by each other, but also, you know, not have a microservice to grab the first letter of somebody's first name and then another microservice to grab the second letter of somebody's first name. And right. So why don't we start with kind of at a high level? We've done a few episodes on domain-driven design, but it's always good to kind of give a bit of a primer about like, what does it actually mean? Like, what are boundaries and why are they so crucial? You know, why data in general is broken by domain-driven design if we just try and do that as straight taking domain-driven design and applying it to data, why that doesn't work quite as well. You have to kind of evolve things a little bit and like your own experience with that. So let's jump into the what is domain-driven design at kind of a high level? How do you explain it to people that are not as familiar?
Yeah, so last time I had to answer this question, what is domain-driven design? It ended up being a 90-page book. But I'll try to do it short. So domain-driven design is a software design methodology that says a simple thing. Software design should be a function of the system's business domain. Now, that sounds like, you know, trivial knowledge, like common sense almost. And the question is, why do you need domain-driven design, the whole methodology, to say exactly the same thing? And well, domain-driven design helps you during all those stages, starting from learning about your business domain, identifying what are its requirements, its strategic needs, and what makes the software system you are developing valuable. The second part of domain-driven design is about designing software. It provides different design patterns and architectural styles to design your software solution. And finally, the third part is connecting the two worlds. How do you draw software design decisions based on your knowledge of the business domain? So I would say that's what domain-driven design for me, a set of tools for, first of all, learning about your business domain, and second, for making software design decisions based on that knowledge of the business domain.
Yeah, and I think I like that you started with the business domain rather than the software side, because I think this is something that we're seeing in data mesh. This is something that we see in all software engineering in general, is that there's the software engineering is the point instead of doing business and learning about your business. And the point of the business to exist is the business. It's not to design more software, right? It may be even if you're selling software, it's not that. So why, like when we're thinking about domain-driven design, you know, what is an actual boundary? Like when you're talking about your line of business or your business domain, what does that actually mean? And why is it important to kind of differentiate what those are? Why is it so crucial to kind of understand essentially what it should be? And you know, you can have different lenses on it. So it doesn't have to be that this is the only way your organization could be mapped. But like, why is it so crucial to really start to think about what are the actual boundaries around a business?
Yeah, so the various tools provided by domain-driven design, all of them in one way or another, either reflecting type of boundaries or providing a way to work across different boundaries. So it's all related to boundaries. But let's start from the beginning, from the business domain analysis. Now, if we stick to domain-driven design's terms, a business domain is a very coarse-grained term. It means the overall industry or the overall service the company is providing to its consumers. Now, of course, usually such coarse-grained terms like domain, well, they can be hard to map to software. That's why we need subdomains. A domain contains multiple subdomains that work together in order to provide that service to the customer. Now, that's where we have a bit of clash of terminologies, because what actually usually called as domain in DDD, it has nothing to do with domains in data mesh. Same is true for subdomains. These are also not the domains you have in data mesh. So subdomains, these are more finer grade business components that are implementing a coherent functionality. Now, speaking strictly in technical terms, we can say that a subdomain is rather a set of coherent use cases that usually work together on the same set of data or implementing closely related business functionalities, or they are just, you know, they change for the same reason. They always change together. So that's what we call a subdomain in domain-driven design. Now, it's easy to fall into making the assumption that subdomains should cover like the whole business, your whole business domain. Now, that's not really true, and that's not really possible, because to really, really analyze the whole how the whole company works, you need something more detailed, like the business capabilities model. This one also has three types of something that is really close to subdomains. But that model is also hierarchical, meaning that, as you said in the introduction, there you can have business capabilities divided into a hierarchy of business capabilities on a lower level. In domain-driven design, on the other hand, it's a more flat model. We have that business domain, which is not really relevant to implementing software. We are more interested in the subdomains that it contains. Now, subdomains, they cannot cover the whole spectrum of business capabilities like the second model does. Instead, our goal here is to focus only on the areas which are actually relevant to software design, to the software that we are designing, software system. So, subdomain is, let's call it a coherent set of use cases. Now, when you identify the subdomains in a business domain, actually what you're doing is you're looking for boundaries that divide those sets of use cases. Why is it important? Because of the second part of domain-driven design. We identify a subdomain, its type, and then use that knowledge to drive software design decisions, like how we are going to implement its business logic, what pattern we are going to use, how we are going to design its architecture, and how we should coordinate the work on those components by different teams, what kind of collaboration patterns they will need to be more efficient at implementing those functionalities. So these are boundaries on a more strategic side, boundaries that you find when you're analyzing your business domains. The second aspect of boundaries is in the tactical part of domain-driven design, where you are designing your software solution. And of course, the first and the most important part of boundaries in this area is identifying your service boundaries or your component boundaries. What we usually call, if you follow domain-driven design terminology, that's a bounded context. Coarse-grained components that implement one or multiple subdomains. Now, bounded contexts are actually way closer to the notion of domains in data mesh.
Yeah, so I mean, I want to go through a couple of things that you said there. One about the DDD, you know, the domain concept is very much not the same as in data mesh. Did you mean that the domain boundaries themselves aren't the same, or even the overall concept is not the same, and that you want to look at that kind of technical bounded context? Like, what did you mean by that?
Yeah. So the concept itself is very different. So in domain-driven design, we are identifying the boundaries of subdomains. This is a function of the business domain. We cannot affect the boundaries of subdomains. What we can do is to make sure that we are identifying the most precise boundaries of those subdomains, but we cannot change them. We cannot change the business functionality. We cannot change the business requirements. On the other hand, when we are designing the software system, when we're defining the boundaries of that system's services or components, these are our design decisions. So if we stick with domain-driven design, we are looking for efficient models describing those subdomains. And the boundary of a model is a bounded context. That's our design decision. So in the data mesh world, that's domain. But in the domain and subdomain, that's not something that we can affect. It's part of the business world. We're just analyzing it and then making software design decisions. And software design decisions, they're not affected only by the business domain. They can also be affected, for example, by your organizational structure. Because if you're just, you know, startup with only one team, well, probably you will need other granularity of component boundaries than, for example, a company with hundreds of teams.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. And so essentially, again, if I can reflect back what you're saying, it's that, if you're following kind of what you're talking about of the domain-driven design, the boundaries are kind of already in place. And a lot of what your work is discovering those and then kind of almost the software component boundaries map directly to your kind of domain boundaries that you have on the business side is one question I have on the software side. But then you were talking about as well, your ability to kind of impact what those boundaries are on the data side. You have a little bit more of an ability to impact that because you can shape a little bit more of those data flow processes and things like that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's correct. So one of the core decisions in domain-driven design is what models you're going to use. What models you're going to use to implement that business functionality. And sometimes it makes sense to use multiple models to represent the same subdomain, for example. In that case, you will have parts of the functionality of a subdomain implemented in multiple bounded contexts because each bounded context contains only one model that is correct in its boundaries. So there will be cases where the same subdomain from the business side will be reflected in multiple bounded contexts. And each of those bounded contexts can have its own data products. So that's why these two types of boundaries, let's call it problem domain boundaries and solution domain boundaries, they're not strictly, they don't have to be exactly the same.
So I think I know what you're saying here is that you can, like when you think about a map, you know, somebody might be looking at the county boundaries or something like that in a country or whatever. And then you start to use the kind of other boundaries of like where, you know, maybe natural boundaries around like lakes or mountains or things like that. Or this is kind of the culture boundaries of this is, you know, I always think of those things of who says what for what different things, you know, like the ones of who says what for soda versus pop or something in the US or what you call those little bugs that when you touch them, they roll up into a little thing. You know, some places they're called centipedes, some places they're called roly-polies, some places they're called like house bugs. And so like what you're saying is that you want to look at it from different perspectives and say, okay, let's choose what's correct. And within data mesh, you want to do the same thing because you have more freedom because you're not necessarily designing the systems in and of themselves. The systems are already there. You're designing the way to extract that information from the systems. Is that the right way to think about it?
Yeah. That can be one way to describe it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Awesome. So I think, again, you know, domain-driven design is a, like you said, you had a 90-page book of just what is domain-driven design. But one thing that I think has been really difficult for a lot of people, especially historically, is getting on the same page between data producers and data consumers, right? That ubiquitous language of actually, like, are we exchanging our context? Are we actually doing this? Like, how do we actually get to that? What does ubiquitous language mean? And then we can go into how do we actually start to move towards that? What have you seen that's actually good? Because these are two, in most organizations, these are two sides that have always been talking through the data team. They haven't been talking to each other. It's data producers and data consumers. And there's been a translator in the middle, and that's, you know, friction point, and it's led to bad translations for all parties. So, like, how do you think about getting to an actual ubiquitous language, and what does ubiquitous language mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. So first of all, a model is a cornerstone concept in domain-driven design. The idea is we are not going to implement like a copy of the real world in software because, well, that's not going to be efficient. At the dawn of our industry, that's what they tried. They like trained domain experts because they had all that knowledge about the business domain. They trained them to write software. Of course, that didn't scale. So right now, we software engineers have to make sense of business domains that we are working in. And, you know, a typical software engineer can have jobs in a variety of business domains, from medical systems to financial ones. And of course, you know, when you start a new job, you cannot become a domain expert in that area. We need something more flexible, a more efficient way of gaining that knowledge. So that's why domain-driven design says, hey, okay, instead of trying to copy the real world, let's find a model that solves a particular problem. That problem is, of course, reflected by that system's goal, the goal of the system you're implementing. And that model has to contain only the absolute minimum knowledge that is required to solve that business problem. Now, how do we come up with such a model? And that's the goal of the ubiquitous language practice. What it says is, in order to understand our domain experts' way of thinking, we have to make sure that we are able to speak to them and to do it in their language, in the language of the business domain. Now, when software engineers are able to communicate with domain experts in the language of the business, that language is what's called in domain-driven design ubiquitous language. And the meaning of the word ubiquitous, it doesn't mean that it should be used everywhere throughout the system. No, the idea is it's ubiquitous in communication between software engineers and domain experts. Now, once we are able to understand the domain expert's way of thinking, once we cultivated that ubiquitous language, it becomes a model that we are implementing in a bounded context. Now, modeling is hard, you know, especially when you are working on some complex business domain or a subdomain that is responsible for your company's competitive advantage. Usually that's something that can be very complex. So domain-driven design says, hey, don't try to find a perfect model right from the get-go. Instead, make this process in iterations. Continuously improve the model as you learn more, as you gain more knowledge about that business domain. And that means that that model is expected to be changed throughout the software system's lifecycle. And that's where frictions usually begin between different components of the system. Because if you're changing a model, that usually affects the boundaries of the relevant component. And once it affects the boundaries, well, whoever is integrated with that component is also going to be affected by it as well. So that's where domain-driven design's tools for optimizing your boundaries come in. And here we have primarily the pattern which is called published language. The idea of published language is that you come up with a different model which is used for integrations. It shouldn't be a copy of your model of the business domain that you're using internally. No, instead of just an integration contract that can have a different, a decoupled life cycle that can evolve independently of your internal implementation model, meaning that you can evolve your internal model without affecting the published language. Now, when it comes to data, usually a published language is the way to go to make sure that your data products are stable and are not affected by, you know, each and every change in your implementation model.
Yeah, so that it's when you're thinking about that ubiquitous language, if we can pop back to that, and then I want to dig into the published language as well. But the ubiquitous language, you said it's only when you're talking with the business people. Like, but you were saying that the software engineers have to speak the language of the business. So when we think about that, it's okay. On the software side, you're trying to kind of do the thing, right? You're trying to actually help them accomplish what they need to on the business side. When we think about that concept on the data side, it's more like we need to reflect what is actually happening in the real world in that business to other people. And so when you think about that ubiquitous language, is it about communicating with the people that are in the domain themselves and understanding? Or is it about how you share that information? Is it how you share that information that the public, like to the rest of the people in the company, right? You've got, you're in domain A and you're talking to a subject matter expert in domain A and you're using your ubiquitous language. When you're talking with a data consumer from domain B, how is that communication established? Is that via the ubiquitous language where you have to understand their context, or is it via the published language? Like, is the published language kind of how you communicate with the rest of the world, and the ubiquitous language is how you communicate within that domain or subdomain?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think you just defined it perfectly. Ubiquitous language, that's what happens inside of a bounded context. That the language that is used for all communication that is related to that functionality of that specific model and encompassed by a single, by one bounded context. That means that the language that should be used by engineers when communicating with domain experts should be able to, you know, to understand that language, meaning that it has to be business language and not design patterns or names of tables and stuff like that. And it's also the language that is used in documentation. And eventually, the code itself, when we are implementing the business logic, it should also speak the ubiquitous language as well. Now, when we are implementing the communication between multiple bounded contexts, meaning that we are integrating multiple models so that they can work together, that's a design decision that we have to make. We have to decide whether how much knowledge we want to expose across the boundaries of a bounded context or service or a domain, if you will. And the most knowledge that we can share is the knowledge of our implementation details. If we expose that outside of our component's boundaries, well, every change to the implementation details has the potential to affect the integration contracts and cause cascading changes. Now, a lower level of knowledge sharing is sharing the knowledge of the models which are used internally. And that means when that model is going to change, it's going to affect external components as well. Now, at different stages of a project, that may be problematic or not. Because, as I said, a model is an iterative process. It takes time to find the most effective, optimized model. So initially, you know, it's going to trigger cascading changes across boundaries. But if the project is more mature and you know that your model is not changing that frequently anymore, well, that may be an acceptable solution, you know, to expose that model across the boundaries. Now, if you want to minimize the chances of those cascading changes happening, that we want to share only the knowledge about the integration contract, which is used between those components, meaning that we have to identify that integration model, which will be used to either share information with the outside world or to accept information from outside world, and decouple its definition, its schema from your implementation models. And that's published language. That's the idea of published language. A model which is optimized for integrating components. That's what happens across bounded contexts.
That's really helpful, because I think it's when we think about what Data Mesh is trying to do, there are people that are creating data products that, you know, the data quanta in the ubiquitous language. So they are saying this is close to the source systems. This has knowledge about that is, you know, relatively close to how we actually store it in our source systems. And then they're not exposing those to people. You know, maybe if somebody wants that raw data and that, but then they're creating data quanta that are only in the published language when somebody comes to them and requests that, right? That there's a use case. So that way they can change their source data products more frequently. Now that's, mm-hmm. that's not something that I've seen in a lot of places. Amara Gafur in her episode 133 was talking about this. And I think it's a really interesting model because it means that they kind of create a pool of source data that is much easier to serve downstream use cases when people come to them with business use cases versus kind of what you were talking about of one thing that a lot of people are struggling with is how do I share like what my data about the domain when I have no idea as to the use case. And so that's kind of where like you'd say, okay, you just have to share all your data on the outside, everything you should share in a published language, but you don't know what language that the other people are speaking before, you know? So you're like, I'm going to go publish in Esperanto, right? Esperanto is this language that was created that was supposed to be like the new global world language. And William Shatner actually did a movie in Esperanto, if anybody wants to go look that up. So he spoke it at one point. I don't know if he's still fluent, but what you're talking about is where there's a big, big friction in doing this for data right now is that people aren't sure of the model, right? And so how do we expose, like, do we want to expose our data in the domain for people and just say, we think this might be how people might want to use it versus them telling us exactly how they want to use it? So like, how do you think about those integration contracts? How do you think about that published language? And getting to that, right? And let's talk about that within data. And so, you know, what have you seen that actually works well when you're talking about domain-driven design for data? You know, big question, but like, what have you seen that works well, or what do you think will work well, or any anti-patterns, any of that is going to be helpful for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. So as you said, published language gives you this strength of not only evolving your implementation model without affecting your integration contracts, but it also gives you the power of generating multiple published languages from the same implementation model, meaning that you can expose different versions of the published language simultaneously. So you're giving your consumers an opportunity to switch to a newer version when you know they have time and not introduce those cascading deployments. Now, that's really important because as an implementation model, the integration contract, it's also a learning process. It also needs a few iterations to find the perfect integration contract. Now, to be honest, I don't really believe in those models that are supposed to be like a jack of all trades. A model that's supposed to solve all kinds of problems for all kinds of consumers, because that's kind of contradict the notion of a model. A model is a tool that's oriented at solving a specific problem, finding a solution for one problem, but it does it well. Now, if we are speaking about bounded contexts and there are no consumers for that data. Well, to be honest, I wouldn't share it. I would wait for the consumers to come in and ask, and I will have a conversation with them to better understand what they need. And that kind of reminds me of one project that I used to work on. So initially we started with like typical data lake where we just dump all of our database into flat files, then analysis team picked it up, parsed it, and used it for BI. Now, worked great initially, but frictions became very, very frequent when, you know, we started changing the implementation model. Because our database, which is being used in a bounded context, it reflects our ubiquitous language. Now, if we were being like good DDD practitioners, we are evolving that model, we are changing it. But guess what? The people on the other side, they are not happy about those changes. Like, there is a lot of friction and drama about every change. They needed to be communicated to them. Now, what happened was this situation demotivated us from evolving the model. And that's really a shame because, okay, that's not domain-driven design if you're not improving your model. So what we eventually ended up doing is saying, hey, so you need to analyze this data. You have to make sense of all those tables and connections between them. Instead, what would be the perfect schema? Like if you were living in a dream world, what would be the perfect schema that would be most convenient to you and you won't have to spend a lot of time parsing it and adapting it? Just describe it. So we got it. And we used it as a published language of that bounded context, that exact schema that they asked for. To implement it, we used I'm switching now to low-level technical details. We used the SQRS pattern. That's a pattern, architectural pattern that allows you to represent the same data in multiple persistent models. So the data we were representing is the data which is owned by a bounded context, and we used SQRS to generate different published languages, and one of them was for analysis purposes. We converted our implementation model into exactly the same schema that they wanted, like their perfect scenario. Now, that gave us freedom, you know, to evolve the implementation model. As long as we were able to convert it to the same published language, well, we can evolve our model. That's not a big deal. And it also made it easier to expand the integration contract, to introduce different versions. At one point, you know, I think we had three different published languages for the same bounded context. Eventually, two of them were retired and only the most recent one remained relevant, but the migration period was really painless. So that's my experience of using domain-driven design tools for making peace with data people.
Yeah, well, and I think that's so. I have a couple of questions in there that I want to talk about, but I like what you're talking about as to one of the big issues that when we try and say domain, you now own your data, you have to share whatever you've got that should be shared. You have to build the published language, and so you again are publishing into the void, right? And so when you publish into the void, you don't know what the reception is going to be like. You don't know, you know, you're broadcasting out there. You don't know if it's AM or if it's FM or if it's, you know, if you radio signal or, you know, some kind of digital or, you know, binary or whatever. So what you're talking about though is within Data Mesh, where I see a lot of friction right now is going to the domain and saying, you now need to publish this stuff in a published language and there, go do it. Versus like, hey, we're going to come to you and we're going to help you learn how to do this. We're going to help you with your actual data model, that exact published language, all that stuff as to how do we want to consume this. So two things that I'd like to kind of talk about within that is, in the model that you did that works, because it is the model that I'm seeing more and more as you're kind of putting words to it. It's like, oh yeah, that's the people that are being successful are doing that. One is how do you maintain your freedom where you're not coupled to your published language? And then I totally forgot what the second one is, but I'll remember it once you answer that first question. So if you could help people understand how the published language doesn't evolve or can be relatively static, and but while you have your freedom, like how did you maintain that without having kind of them drift more and more apart, and then it became more and more effort to take your ubiquitous language and put it into the published language?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I want to start with this word publish, because it can be confusing for the people new to domain driven design. It kind of sounds like this language is published, like asynchronously to some pub-sub mechanism or whatever. That's not the idea. The idea is that it's published like a document which is published. It describes your public interface. It can be synchronous or asynchronous. It doesn't matter. That's your boundary. How data is going out of your component or how it comes in. It describes the public interface. It doesn't have to be asynchronous. Now, from the implementation side, well, it actually depends. It depends on the type of public interface that you are working on, because it can be synchronous or asynchronous, for example, like through a REST API or through a message bus. But it can also be more of a data-oriented, like exposing a database, a relational model containing the data in one of the published languages. Now, the translation from implementation model to published language depends on the type of the interface that you're working on. If it's an asynchronous endpoint, for example, that publishes domain events, well, what you can do is implement message translator pattern, something that listens for events published by your bounded context, transform them to one of the integration contracts that describe the messages that you are publishing asynchronously and publish that resulting message to some topic. If you're implementing a REST API, which is synchronous, you can implement the translation in your controllers, for example. That would be a simplest way to do it. Like in your presentation logic or your service layer, you're translating the integration contract into the proper calls to your implementation model. And finally, if you need to expose data, for example, as in exposing a database with integration-oriented schema, well, then you can use the CQRS pattern to regenerate those models in those shared databases. Now, I want to stress this word shared database, because, you know, microservices and domain-driven design, these are quite related words, and sharing data through a database is a big no-no in microservices world. So I want to explain a bit how it still makes sense. So if you're sharing data through your implementation model, your implementation database, well, that's a big no-no, because you want to change the schema independently. You don't want to affect other consumers. However, if you introduce an additional database which is intended for integration, that's okay. That's just another type of integration contract. And that's actually how data products are exposed in bounded contexts that follow the data mesh thinking when they're exposing products as a service. And also the predefined model, the pre-generated data can be used when you're implementing, for example, a REST API, but you cannot translate that data on the fly, those models on the fly all the time, because either it consumes too many resources, or for example, it's just not possible because you want to do a search. Then again, you can pre-generate those models, store them in the published language database, and use it as for implementing your integration contracts.
And the question that I'm asking as well is that, so one big issue that I've heard people telling me is a problem, is that maintaining, first of all, establishing those integration contracts, right? When we think about data contracts, like what actually, you know, there's not even just schema, there is also meaning, right? There is the semantics of it within a data contract, because you can refactor something and it won't break your schema contract, which might break your integration contract, right? Where you say, hey, we're sharing the same thing, but it means something totally different and we didn't tell you. Like, that's a bad thing to do. So like, what have you seen that works well for maintaining that integration contract as you're constantly evolving? Is it simple like tooling that says, hey, this is going to have this impact on the integration contract? Or like, because this is where people are really struggling, right? That the software engineers have never really had to expose data in a way that is for analytics. And so if the only thing that they have to now learn is how to data model, that's much, much, much easier than if we have to teach them how to data model and do all the versioning and do all this other things where there's just more challenges around those integration contracts, those what in Data Mesh are data contracts. So how have you seen people maintain those, or how have you seen people establish those? Because you were also talking about, you don't want a super generalist model, but you also don't want overly specific, because then that becomes compute intensive, you know, costly. It becomes very, very obnoxious to maintain if you've got like 15 different consumers that you're like, I now have 15 different integration contracts that are in 15 different published languages, right? Where you're sharing things in such a way that where you don't want to get overly specific, but you also don't want to be overly generic, where it doesn't really tell the person anything and they have to do all the work once they've consumed the data. So, you know, I'm kind of asking you to thread the needle, but like, is there anything that you would tell people? I'm not asking you to solve it, but is there anything that you've seen that works well for setting up and maintaining those integration contracts where it doesn't become too much sprawl and it is specific enough that it is helpful for the people consuming from it? So kind of big question, but what have you seen that works there?
Mm-hmm. Well, look, first of all, I want to stress the point of published language is to have this model which will change way less frequently than your implementation model.
Exactly, yes.
It should be more stable. But of course, it still can change, especially in the initial stages of the development, because, well, as we work, as time passes, we learn more, and we have to use that added knowledge to implement a better solution. And in our world of software design, that means we have to develop more effective boundaries for our components. Now, documentation always helps, whether it's using open API for defining the schema, for example. Now, the terminology itself, it can be very problematic because, as you've said, the same term can have multiple meanings in different bounded contexts, in different models. So the big question is, what kind of terminology do you expose? Should it reflect your needs or something very generic? Now, if it's overly generic, as you've said, it's really hard to define it because usually somebody is not going to be happy about it. Somebody will complain.
So, yeah. And so I think what you were talking about of not being overly generic, like this is where people are struggling as to how generic or how non-generic should you be. And you know, the answer is always kind of, it depends, but like, how are you seeing that those published languages, how do we keep those from becoming coupled, or how do we continue to have the same published language when your integration or your implementation model has changed so much that what's in the published language is no longer relevant to the implementation model? Like, we've seen this with people talking about how often a software engineer or a developer will drop a column, and that column was incredibly important for somebody downstream, but you just still have that column there. And if somebody's not populating it anymore, right? Like, okay, when somebody is doing a sign up, we're collecting these 15 different things. Okay, the people downstream are consuming those 15 different boxes that somebody had to fill out. Oh, well, we've cut it down, we've streamlined it, and now it's only 10. Those people downstream are saying, you can't drop that column, but that column is no longer, there's no new data in that column either. So, like, how do we make it so that the published language doesn't become a hindrance? And how do we make it so that we can continue to do the implementation model in the way that we need to? That's kind of the question I'm getting at. And it's a very, very, very difficult question, because it is, the reason why I'm asking it and the reason why I'm trying to dig in here is because I haven't heard anybody give me a viable answer here. And a lot of times it depends, or we're still learning how, or, you know, that, but like, that's what I'm asking for, is have you seen something that others can at least take inspiration from and then try and apply it to data? Because we're really struggling with these concepts. That integration contract is the data contract, and people are super, super struggling with how to actually measure those, maintain those, like, set those up so that they can evolve. But then, you know, data consumers are like, no, your published language can never evolve. And, you know, all of these different complications. But like, on the software engineer side, like, I don't expect them to solve all of the problems, but what can they solve? And then what do we have to solve at the platform level to make it so that this is actually something that that they don't have to know absolutely everything, that the way that every bit of data that they could ever produce is consumed downstream? Like, is there something we can do in the platform, or do consumers need to register their use case and say, this is exactly how we're using it, and we'll tell you if it's changing, and so that they're aware? Like, have you seen anything that actually works? Because this is one of the key friction points in just data in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the answer is it depends. Okay. Now, seriously, so in domain-driven design, we have this saying, make implicit explicit. Now, once you make something that was implicit more explicit and you're aware of it, well, it makes it easier to manage it. And that is true for models as well. Now, when I defined published language, I said the implementation model can evolve independently as long as it can be translated in the same published language. So going back to your example, in this case, it doesn't answer that requirement. That change breaks the integration. You can no longer generate that published language. Now, if that happens, I would advise to start from the published language, to generate a new published language without that column. And once your subscribers have migrated to the new model, then you can remove the column from the implementation model as well. Now, of course, it depends on what kind of change you're implementing. The goal is to have an integration contract that is way, way more stable than your implementation model, that gives you the freedom to change, to evolve your implementation. Of course, that's not always possible. In these cases, we have to be creative, and, you know, we have to think how to plan the migration. And sometimes, yeah, we have to do it starting from the API. We have to update the API to make sure that our consumers are not depending on that irrelevant model, a column. And only afterwards, we can remove it safely from the implementation model. Now, speaking in terms of overly generic or overly specific, that's a hard question. I always prefer to have the integration contracts being oriented towards solving a particular problem or a need for one of the consumers. That way, you know, I know that it works for the problem that it was supposed to solve. If tomorrow I will need to solve another problem, well, tomorrow I will think about it, whether I will extend my existing published language or introduce another one. Again, if these published languages are explicit and are managed correctly, it's easy to modify them or introduce new ones. As long as, again, this is explicit, not some like a bunch of if statements all over the code. That's not manageable, of course. It has to be managed. It has to be, those boundaries have to be explicit. Once you have them, it gives you more freedom to manage that complexity, the complexity of those cascading changes. So speaking about granularity, I prefer it to be specific as much as possible, because making data too generic will always make somebody not happy. There will be some consumer that will ask for a set of changes. Now, in domain-driven design, there is another pattern which can be used in tandem with published language, and that's anti-corruption layer. Anti-corruption layer is, the idea is the same. The idea is translating one model into another one, but from a different perspective. Instead of using it as your integration contract for communicating data outside of your component, an anti-corruption layer is a protection mechanism against ineffective models exposed by other components that you are consuming. Meaning that if other component communicates its data in a language that contradicts your internal model, for example, it gives a different meaning to one of your terms, you can put an anti-corruption layer that will translate that model into one that matches your implementation model. So the idea is the same. We are translating the model, but the models from a different perspective. Instead of translating what we are sharing with outside world, we are translating information that we are getting from an external component. We are adapting it to a model which is more convenient for our component. Now, when I said translating ineffective models, it doesn't mean that, you know, the team that produced those models, they're doing a bad job, you know. No, they can be doing a perfect job, but their model can still be conflicting with the one that you are using internally. So to fix that collision of terms or just business assumptions, you have to introduce an anti-corruption layer.
Yeah, and people are looking at this from like trying to do this at the documentation level of like taxonomies and things like that, which become difficult because they can become central, and central prevents, you know, iteration and prevents that. But I think, yeah, it sounds like what you're saying is something I've been talking about a little bit, which is almost that every consumer should register their use case, because then you can have the conversation about that published language. Should I extend it, or do I need a new published language, right? Do I need something that's going to, can I do a couple of tweaks? And it's all about what are your needs, right? Okay, somebody really needs very, very, very high accuracy. Okay, then they can have something that's on a much more delayed consumption, versus somebody's like, I need it within X amount of time, or I need this, or whatever, that we can start to have those, and we can prevent sprawl in a lot of cases. But it's worse to try and serve everybody from the same thing. It's kind of like if you were to go to a restaurant and they mixed all of their meals together. So that way, you know, whatever meal you want, there's some of your meal in there, but it's just a big conglomeration of gross, versus like, you know, but when you're cooking for your family or something like that, you don't want to cook an individual meal for each member of your family, unless mm-hmm. maybe you do. I don't know. That's your business. But that's certainly not a model that I think works. So I think kind of balancing that is important. So I did want to jump into one last topic as we're coming up on an hour here. But the one question that I think is really making people concerned about applying DDD to data, or one of the big ones, is like, how do you detect when things need to change, right? Like you've set up your domains, you've set up your, you know, you've got your models, you've got all of these things. It's not that your implementation model itself needs to change. It's that your boundaries need to change. How do you detect that? Or what have you seen that are good ways to kind of look for to say, hey, we might want to at least reevaluate these, not that, you know, before it becomes, you know, a four-alarm fire. It's like, hey, there's some smoke. Let's go see if there's fire here, if we need to put it out or if it's nothing.
Yeah, great question. So, you know, we can grab a page from how our bodies work. How does our body tell us that we have to change something? It sends us pain signals. So in software engineering, I think pain is often ignored, but it's an awesome heuristic for identifying situations when something needs to be changed. For example, if you have two finer grade boundaries of your microservices and it's painful to deploy them because always you have to coordinate changes in multiple services, well, guess what? That's pain signals you that your boundaries are ineffective. Or, for example, if it's painful to deploy a component because every deployment causes frictions with other teams. Well, guess what? Probably the integration contract is ineffective, and that's why you have that pain. So that's something that can be used to identify situations where your design should be adopted or something has to be changed after the fact. Now, of course, we'd prefer to identify those cases before the pain kicks in. And here, if we follow domain-driven design, then we'll have to take into consideration what are those aspects of system design that are affecting our software design decisions. And first and foremost, that's our business domain. And second, it's the organization that implements that software. Now, business domain can change over time, and it changes especially frequently in startups at early stages, because many times when a startup company opens one, in many cases, they are not sure what problem they are going to solve for their customers, let alone the solution they are going to provide. So everything changes, the business priorities change, and that affects the subdomains. It affects their boundaries, and it affects their types. Within talk about it earlier, but subdomains come in different types. A subdomain can be core, supporting, or generic. Each requires a different mindset for implementing its functionality in code. So if type changes, you have to identify that and adapt your design. Another type of business domain related changes is the changes in knowledge, because, well, as we said, software engineer cannot be expected to be a domain expert. So when a team starts working on a new business domain, the business domain that is new for them, as time passes, they are going to be more and more familiar with that business domain. They will have more knowledge. And that knowledge is going to either invalidate some of their assumptions, or it can give them breakthrough into how to design the system in a better, more optimized way. Again, that's a sign to implement that change, to adapt your model. Now, the organization that implements the system also affects the design. Because if you're working in a small company, probably having more wider boundaries for your services, for your components, is going to be more effective from the software engineering perspective. But as the company grows, you will have to decompose those wide boundaries into finer grade components so that multiple teams are not going to overlap in each other's work, so that each team can work on its own component. Now, when you're decomposing those larger components into smaller ones, again, it's going to affect your models, it's going to affect how they're integrated, and it's going to affect how the teams are communicated. And again, in domain-driven design, we have different set of patterns for how to design those integrations, depending on both the types of subdomains at play and the organizational factors. For example, how well the teams implementing integrated components, how well they can collaborate and communicate with each other. It also affects software design. In my book, I have a chapter called Evolving Design Decisions, specifically about that, where I talk about different types of changes that we have to be cautious for, that we have to look for in order to identify those changes in the software design before it leads to pain.
Yeah, I think that's very, very helpful. I think that's a good framing. And I think that's a good way to kind of close out what we've been talking about. Of like, hey, you're not going to get it right up front. It's okay to not get it right up front. Set yourself up to iterate and like look for these things. Be prepared that they're going to happen. And that, you know, we need to as well talk with consumers that there's going to be versioning, things are going to change, but that we're going to work with them to prevent those integration contracts from breaking, because then it's not a contract. It's just kind of a vague promise from somebody you don't trust. And then you can't really trust the data, which means you can't leverage it and all that. So we covered a whole heck of a lot related to DDD and DDD for data. So is there anything we didn't cover that you wanted to, or any way you'd want to kind of wrap up the episode in general?
Yeah, we'll add a small thing. You know, usually people are afraid of domain-driven design because it's like a big topic and a lot of patterns, a lot of stuff to learn. But you don't have to apply all of it, you know, to make DDD work for you. It can be very beneficial even to apply certain parts of domain-driven design. For example, if you are working on a brownfield project, well, you cannot change everything in one day. You have to apply DDD gradually. So you can start applying different types of patterns to make your boundaries explicit, to identify models, etc., etc. And that will make your solution better designed, even if you're not going to apply the whole array of tools provided by domain-driven design. And again, in my book, I have a chapter called Domain-Driven Design in Real Life, where, you know, I talk about how can we apply domain-driven design like in real life, where everything is problematic and it's hard to change and not everyone is on board, how to work with that and still benefit from domain-driven design.
Yeah, unfortunately, this stuff is not done in a lab, right? It's real world, it's real businesses, and people keep saying, well, how can I just find my domain map? And it's like, well, you have to do the work. You can't just go and say, here's the industry standard domain map. Vlad, this has been very, very helpful for me, especially in framing more around DDD and kind of thinking about what terminology we can use and how we can take this and apply it to data. So I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people that would like to follow up with you. Where's the best place? Anything specific you'd like them following up about?
So I guess all my news I announced on Twitter. It's at Vladik, double K, or on LinkedIn. I have a blog, which is kind of sad because it doesn't get any attention lately, but I hope to get back to blogging sometime. But first, I have to finish that third book.
Well, we'll drop links to all of that and the books as well in the show notes. So, Vlad, again, thank you so much for spending the time with me today. And as well, thank you everyone out there for listening.
Thank you so much, Scott, for having me.
I'd again like to thank my guest today, Vlad Kononoff, who's the author of Learning Domain-Driven Design, or DDD, through O'Reilly. He's a senior cloud architect at Doit International, and he's also an independent consultant on DDD and distributed systems. You can find a link to his LinkedIn and his book in the show notes as per usual. Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for listening to another great guest on the Data Mesh Learning Podcast. Thanks again to our sponsors, especially DataStax, who actually pays for me full-time to help out the Data Mesh community. If you're looking for a scalable, extremely cost-efficient, multi-data center, multi-cloud database offering and or an easy-to-scale data streaming offering, check DataStax out. There's a link in the show notes. If you want to get in touch with me, there's links in the show notes to go ahead and reach out. I would love to hear more about what you're doing with Data Mesh and how I can be helpful. So please do reach out and let me know, as well as if you'd like to be a guest. Check out the show notes for more information. Thanks so much.